It's time again for Alaska Tracks on KFAR Radio with stories about the people that made Alaska the great land. Alaska Tracks is brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters. And now, Alaska Tracks with your host, Randy Zarnke.
Hello again, Fairbanks. Welcome back to Alaska Tracks, your favorite program for stories from old-time hunters and guides and trappers and pilots. I'm your host, Randy Zarnke. I occasionally hear from listeners who are enjoying these walks down memory lane. These comments make me feel pretty good. I'm glad you enjoy it. Last week, we started our interview with Herman Ludwigson of Wrangell. Herman was a dedicated outdoorsman, whether it was hunting or fishing or trapping. He was also a pilot, which allowed him easy access to the good places for those activities. Let's hear a few more stories from Herman.
Did you use any of your furs for making garments for your family, or most of them were sold?
Was sold, most of them. Like you see on your chairs around here, there's otter hanging around here and wolf hides everywhere. But I sold most of the wolf hides. I'd skin them and salt them and sell them for $50. Some of the blacks went for higher price. I got quite a bit for some black wool. At them days, we could get the bounty for a while, $50. The Wolverine, the same thing. I sold those. They were a good price. In fact, I traded one nice Wolverine, a big one, to Tongass Trading Company in Ketchikan for a Blaze King wood stove. Wood stove was worth $900. Back into the trapping days back in the 40s with Norm Olson in Chomley, we had a few game wardens down there. One was Dan Ralston, a real nice gentleman of a guy, and he was a hard one. He wanted to catch people, and then he had an assistant called Johnny Wendler, another real tough guy. They would snowshoe across in Chomley from one bay to the other trying to catch us or this guy, the Islander, this guy trapping, this Rastus Brown. Mm-hmm. These guys were tough. I mean, they were the old-time game wardens, and they knew how to catch people. They caught a few. We tried not to break the law. Respected them. They were good game wardens. They were honest. They didn't try to lie or entrap you into anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they caught you on your boat skinning a beaver out of season because you want to eat something, they'd take you. Well, they'd come aboard and have coffee, and they wouldn't snoop or tear you apart. I really like Dan Ralston. I don't know if he's alive today or not, but they were good guys. And another guy named Frank Sharp. A little later on in years in Ketchikan, I think he was from Angoon or Hoona. He's part native and little fella. And he was the toughest of tough. He wanted everybody that was trapping or shooting deer going to jail because you were breaking the law. We flew most of the week, and I'd get the weekends off, and I'd use the Super Cub. And it was some tough flying in the wintertime down here, too, especially back in the mainland. And some of these bays were half froze. You'd bust a little ice trying to get into them, which ain't good for floats. You'd usually hit the beach on an incoming tide, not on an outgoing tide with a float plane. Otherwise, you'll be there for the next 12 hours. I love the woods, and I've had anything from a 300 Weatherby Magnum to a 300 lever action Savage. Did a lot of goat hunting. I got a few goat heads around and hides, some not trophy deer, but some nice big Sitka blacks.
Well, tell us about your favorite goat hunt.
Well, we had so darn many. In the earlier days, we could fly and hunt the same day, and it was nice to be able to go on out and fly into the backcountry behind Ketchikan and find some of these goats up in the alpine, and you'd pick out what you wanted. And I went out one day early in the morning and for daylight, which most guys do. They like to get up early, get in there, and get the hunt started early. And I went up the Ladue River behind Ketchikan, and I had a guy spotted up there from before. I went up to a real high lake. It's a beautiful lake, small. It's about 3,200 foot elevation on the lake.
So you were pushing the capability of your airplane.
Yeah, with me, and then depending on the wind, and on the north end of the lake, there's a little bit of ice and a little bit of a glacier coming down on the inside of it, which is beautiful. Sandy beach up there, too. But I had to scale that cliff on the lower end of the lake up high, way up. And I could see the guy. He knew I was coming. He was a big billy, a real nice goat. Him and I, we watched each other for quite a while. I was hanging on to berry bushes, and I was a better climber than the goat was at that time, I think. But I got him cornered up there. He got to where he couldn't get out. And he knew it, and he just stopped and stared at me. There's no way he could go, and I popped him. There's the catch to this one. That's why I picked this story for one of the many I've done. Once I got him, I didn't want to throw him down where I had come. But I had to go below the lake a little bit and then back up again to get to where I could get up this guy. And I didn't want to take the goat down that way. So I took him across a small ice field at his elevation. I got over on top of this ice field, and it was like a big chute. Most people know that hunt goats, they don't float. They don't have hollow hair like deer or moose. And once you throw him in the water, he's gone. He sinks. unless you don't clean them. If you leave the intestines in and the lungs and everything, he'll float. So I stuck him out in this ice field and gave him a boot, and down he went. He must have went about 1,500 feet or so on this ice, just sliding, and he went whoosh, kind of like he was flying.
A ski jump.
Yeah, and he hit the water. I got down to the water and tied him to the Super Cub and towed him to the other end of the lake where that sandbar was up by the glacier, and rolled him up on the sand and cleaned him and washed him off again, of course, after all the sand. Tied him to the Super Cub and struggled home. But he was a dandy. Nice goat. But I've also shot some that are so darn big I couldn't pack. Goats have such a big brisket, it's tough to take the whole animal. This another one I had to cut his head off. Then I could move him. He was so big. But that was a big guy.
Tell us a little bit about goat meat. Is that good eating?
It is good eating, but, you know, after you eat so much, it's a sweeter meat. It's like mutton, at least at our taste, the wife and I. We liked it for quite a while. But then after you start shooting a deer and then you get a moose, and you wonder sometime, why the heck are you climbing so darn high for this white fool that lives up there in the mountains? I took a lot of guys goat hunting with Weber Air. They request me because I was crazy enough to go into these lakes and find these animals for them. And a lot of people from the States contact Weber Air and want to fly with Herman to take him goat hunting. And even had some German couples with us, did those things too. Set up camp for them, help them out, and did a lot of that.
So you were famous?
Sort of. I was in the Alaska Sportsman way back in 1946 when I had my own boat fishing. Bruce Johnstone, Kit Carson, and Jack Johnstone, Bruce's brother, and myself, and Pete Sessnan, and we made our own flat-bottom riverboat. Took my boat up to the mouth of the Unic River, and so we anchored my boat on the saltwater, took this flat-bottom boat up the river, and hunting moose. Got a moose, by chance. And the only reason we got the darn moose, I was standing on a sandbar, and everybody else was sitting in the boat down at the edge on the river, and I walked into the brush a ways. I don't know what I was thinking of, but I went in there, and I had an axe with me. And I was getting cold, so I said, well, I'll do some chopping and banging away on this log just to warm up a little bit. Lo and behold, I think most of the other fellows that have been around the woods know that this sounded like a moose fight, chopping and banging, something against alders. Nice big bull walks up. So we nailed him, and that was the only one we got on that trip. But Bruce Johnstone and I, we were up in there, too, with airplanes, with Luscombs. We landed in Lake Crick and Jean's Lake up the Unic, quite a ways up, close to the border. And that was in 46, 47, somewhere in there. And Bruce and I had a two-man life raft, one of the old military little yellow things that were dangerous enough for one guy to get into and float around in. And Bruce said, Herman, let's float down the damn river. So, yeah, okay, fine. The rest of the guys flew out. And Bruce and I got in this little damn dinghy. Bruce manned the oars because he'd been working the river a lot. He was guiding on the river. You run the rope. He said, if I holler, you jump and run that rope. We don't want to come around the corner and not know what we got. Get underneath the swifter, we'll drown. So I sat close to the edge with long line, and lo and behold, we did pretty good. But when we first hit the river, Bruce didn't know it, and I didn't know it. I don't think anybody knew it that had any sense about living in the woods. Once we hit that plastic boat in the water, the sand in that river, in any river, mostly if it's a swift river like the Unic or the Chickaman down in the southeastern part, the sand is moving continuously, moving and pretty fast. And we got in that damn boat and started drifting down the river. And Bruce, I said, do you hear that sizzling noise? It sounds like we've got a damn leak. We got to get out of here. So we we run it to the beach and jumped out. And then we got to thinking, well, sure, that sand going to bottom with this plastic. Kind of scary. I didn't want to swim.
How about deer?
Deer, that's good high country stuff, too. I've got a few trophies back in the back room there that I've won a few entries in Ketchikan for local pilots. Been dropped off a few times by one of my friends that just died recently, too, Terry Wills. He dropped me off in a high lake, and I had my little tent and a throwaway sleeping bag and a little camp stove, and I walked from the lake up to the high country and camped on top. Beautiful night, beautiful morning. I woke up and ate a few crackers or whatever I had. I don't remember what it was, but shot two nice big bucks. The limit was four. So I got these two dressed out, and I started dragging them one at a time down where there's a lake below us, which I was supposed to be picked up on. It was a bigger lake, but it was lower elevation, probably about 1,500 feet lower than we landed in. And I took these two deer down to where it's kind of a chute, kind of a ravine, and I could get the deer down that way easy. And so I went back up a little ways farther and shot two more. So I had four big deer down. When you're a pilot like I had been for years and been in the woods so darn much, the weather started to change, and you get the feeling that maybe something's going to happen, and you notice the sky, everything turns, and pretty soon everybody knows how southeast is. You don't wait too long. You better get in and get out, or you're going to get stuck. So So I got these four deer down to the lake, and I still had my little tent and a little bit of junk to eat. And I sat there on the edge of that lake, and it was just close to getting dark, and it started to rain, and the fog set in. And there I was, soaking wet and tired. I could hear the airplane circling out around the outside of the headwaters of the lake, and it was Terry Wills who had dropped me off. And he knew I was in there, but he couldn't land. It was damn near dark and pretty late to make camp. So I found a dry spot on a side hill and pitched that little tent and crawled in that disposable sleeping bag and shivered and shook all night long. And I didn't have much to eat. I had a little fire going, but the wife had made some stew. It was in a little plastic jug, and I had some of that, and that helped. But it was plenty wet, and I didn't have a raincoat. And I had plastic bags, so I cut a hole in a plastic bag, stuck it over my head, and kept my body fairly well dry. And the next morning, still the same weather, rotten. And I hung the deer up, took a deer heart and liver in my pocket, and packed up my junk and went back up the mountain. I figured the only way I'm going to get out of here was to get back up this damn mountain and back down the other side to salt water. So up I went, up top again, went back down the other side where it was pretty steep and slides and ravine like most of Southeast is. It was pretty tough going down, but going downhill ain't too bad. I got down to salt water, and of course they don't know where I was. I mean, there you make a mistake, you went the wrong way, you're not in the lake, where in the hell are you? But I got down in salt water, I found a nice place to camp under a big cedar tree. I made almost a fatal mistake, which I think most people know better than I do. I had a can of Sterno, which helps start fires, and I had a pack of matches. And I thought, the only place that's dry on me is in that can. So I put the matches in there. I got down to the salt water on the other side. That was the second day. And I made camp under the cedar tree and some stumps, got a little fire going. But the only reason, here's why I mentioned the matches in the Sterno. There was about 8 matches in that little can. And every one of them wouldn't light but one, because they got damp, that alcohol. Bad mistake. But I got that one match going, and I lit that can of Sterno, and I got some cedar from the side of a tree and got a fire going and spent the night there, raining and blowing like all get out. I was comfortable enough. Then I knew I was on salt water, and I could get clams or I can get mussels or something to eat down there. As long as I had a fire going, I was fine. They found me the next day, and the only reason they found me is that I heard airplanes flying around. I could see them flying around, whether they're cleared. And I got out on the edge of the salt water, and I was throwing rocks out in the water to make a wake. And most pilots down here, they know damn well that ducks don't keep making big splashes in the water. Something is down there. So they made a low pass, and they saw me standing on the beach.
So did they yell at you for not staying where you were supposed to be?
No, they were younger pilots, and I had trained them how to fly. Oh, okay. So they better not. But everybody was happy to see me in Ketchikan. But my deer soured. I couldn't save them. We couldn't get back in there. Once they got me home, I tried to explain to the guys where they were. And I guess Bear got to them. They were gone.
Great stuff, Herman. I envy you the life you lived. Let's go to a few words from our sponsors. Those sponsors keep this program going. Please thank them if you get a chance. Now back to our interview with Herman Ludwigson of Wrangell.
I had a good story about moose hunting up on the Anoka River when I was living in Bethel. Took a young kid up there named Jackie Stewart. From Bethel, we flew up with my 180 past Holy Cross to the Anoka River. We saw a nice big bull back in the swamp right behind one of the sloughs we landed in. He was a fair-sized animal. It was close to rutting season. I had a different rifle with me. I had a 33 Winchester, which used to be a 45-70 Army bullet. I had it tooled down to a 33 Winchester. We got in the brush in there where that moose was, and for some reason, Stewart, the other guy who was with me, he went around the backside, and I stood down by the beach behind a tree. And lo and behold, that moose came after me. I know we went around the tree at least 3 times. He was serious. He was going after me. He didn't think that I should be there.
So you had the rifle, why aren't you doing some shooting?
I did. I didn't slip on anything that I accidentally dropped. But I popped them, finally. I take charters up there out of Bethel and go up in the Anoka with different people from Bethel and around the villages there going moose hunting. And in them days, it was pretty cheap. We figured a couple hundred bucks, take a guy up and shoot a moose and be home the same afternoon. On one of our trips up in there, I run into a almost pure white bull. Beautiful guy, and I got awfully close to him. The only brown on him was right down the center of his backbone. Started from the back of his neck down, not quite to his tail, but the rest was white, pure white. He was beautiful. At that time, I realized, boy, there's some big bucks down here for me if I could get this thing. But I didn't want to kill him. I got back to Bethel, and I called Flash Hikers Zoo and Museum down in the States, in the San Diego Zoo. I called three different outfits down in the States about this white animal that we could tranquilize and fly him down there, and they would have him on display. And I don't think all three were the same answers, but it came out the same to me. They said, we don't deal in freaks. I think they made a bad mistake. This is a beautiful animal. He's gone now. So that was quite a while ago. That was back in the late 50s. I don't think the Eskimos there at Holy Cross or around the Shagaluk or Holy Kachuk or Grayling would have killed him. They would think there was some kind of a spirit to this thing. Because I've heard stories going up through the mail run and landing at Aniak about white-footed bears up by Whitefish Lake, which was east of Aniak towards the Kilbuck Mountains. And they wouldn't shoot them. And to this day, I guess they're still there. We flew into Nyack and to Marble Creek for mail runs with Northern Consolidated. They were talking about them, too. One of the old Eskimos in Bethel, one day he came to the house, everybody was looking for oil. They were muskrat trappers, and they would come down early and hunt muskrats. And he says to my father-in-law in Eskimo dialect, oil up in the mountains, squirrel holes smell like oil. And my father-in-law says, Herman, let's get with it, let's go up there. And we walk a long ways over the tundra towards the hills where we could finally find these. And can you imagine a grown man on his hands and knees smelling squirrel holes? Here we were. But it was just a ground vegetation oil. We have it in Southeast too. But we didn't know. We had to go look.
You thought it'd be your first million.
You betcha. I thought, boy, I got it. I'm out of here. But it was worth looking for. One of my favorite bear stories was up on the Unic River. It's one of our moose hunts up there, but I was alone. I usually hunted moose alone once I got into the Super Cub. I do my own hunting, and I popped a few moose and did my own work. It's hard work. I like to read a lot of the Alaska stories of these guys. This old Frank, the trapper from up Fairbanks that lived out in Denali Park. I read his book, and it's good. And I had done the same thing with a moose. When you're alone, you just take some rope and tie the two top legs to a tree, pull it open so you can get at the intestine, and you'd rip him open and drop all the entrails out, and then you quarter him up and make packs out of it, and I've done that two or three times. But anyway, the bear story, up the Unic River. Here we go with the Super Cub, and I landed up in Lake Creek, and I walked up a stream. I wanted a bear. I wanted a big grizzly. And that's before we needed tags and anything else. I had my .33 Winchester, lever action, and I was walking up in the brush in a fish creek. Sure enough, there's a nice big chocolate brown grizzly trying to get some dog salmon out of the creek. And he saw me, and I saw him, and I shot him twice with the .33. He came out of the creek just a little bit on the first shot. In the second shot, he dropped. I'd shot a few blacks before, but it's my first bear, big one. And I still had three or four more shells. I walked up to the guy. He was laying there in a big brown heap, as everybody knows. A lot of people use a stick to poke him to make sure that he ain't going to come up and take you. But I went up to him and hit him with the barrel of the rifle. You'll never believe what happened. My gun fell apart. The magazine had spring-loaded. It was two little screws on the tip under the barrel that vibrated out. And when I hit the bear with the rifle, all my shells and spring and all laid right in front of him. I said a few words, but he didn't move. I skinned him, fleshed him out, cleaned him up, got him in the Super Cub, brought him back to Ketchikan.
You talk about how much work packing out a moose, that skinning a bear by yourself.
It's no small task. I did all the hard work, and once we got him home, I stretched him out and fleshed him and skinned the ears, the lips, and the paws right down to the last knuckle like you do marten or mink, and had him tanned. Yeah, 46 years of flying. Started out flying with Jim Weber in Ketchikan in 1946. Learning how to fly then with the Weber Air guys, and Pete Sessman and Jim Weber, Don Ross, 33,400 and some hours. Never hurt a person. Had some incidents, of course. Everybody has a few of those. And in my career of flying down here in Ketchikan, I found 8 downed airplanes. Rescued 9 Air Force guys in Bethel. They went down in a C-123 between Bethel and Cape Romanzoff. He hollered Mayday, and the FAA or CAA and M days in Bethel heard it, and they knew I was out there with an airplane, so they told me to go back and look for him, and I found him 20 minutes later. and radioed the FAA or CAA and told them that they were down and all right and sent help. Jimmy Hoffman and the rest of the crew in Bethel came out and we ferried them all back to town. And
never even missed dinner, huh?
Nope, didn't miss dinner. In the early 50s, I found Ellis Hall, an oil millionaire that crashed in Boca de Quadri. Everybody was looking for him, but nobody could find him. And I just happened to be flying by and I looked down in between the trees and here was a piece of the airplane down in there. And I got a $30,000 reward for that. And I was in on that Pan American crash on Tangas Mountain. We were searching for that guy for a long time, too. The Coast Guard found him on the top of the mountain right across from Annette Island. Then we went back up later to retrieve the mail and whatever we could find. They chose us because we were woodsmen, and we lived up on the side of that mountain in the pouring down rain with a little bit of nothing. In fact, Bob Ellis, Ellis Airlines, was the mainstay there in Ketchikan at that time. And they were buzzing us on the side of that darn steep mountain, dropping us sleeping bags and grub, and everything was bouncing all over the side of the mountain. And we tried to retrieve that darn stuff so we could at least survive up there for a week. I retired from flying down Ketchikan, flying for Southeast Stevedoring for 16 years, flying customs, sea pilots, immigration people out the Japanese log ships that were coming. And I retired after that and moved to Wrangell with my son, Manny. And him and I do a lot of hunting together. We do a lot of deer hunting on Zaremba. It's been fun. I enjoyed every bit of it in the woods, and I still would. But now, being 73, why I kind of back off when I look at a hard road or a steep cliff because I had both of my hips replaced, one of them twice. So I hunt with my son, yet. Him and I go out, and he's got a four-wheeler, but I can't ride those. They're too bumpy. So I have to walk, and I walk the old logging roads. And I got a nice big buck right up behind the house here a couple of years ago, a nice big four-point. But he had to come and help me with the four-wheeler because I just can't do that anymore. No goat hunting for me, though. He wants me to buy a Super Cub and go, and I said, no, thank you. I've done my flying. We go fishing on his boat. He got a 32-foot Bayliner and caught some nice king salmon. No big ones, 30, 35s and 40s. His two daughters, they go with him, and they fish, the two bigger girls. And now he's got another one that's 8 years old, and she's a fisher. And those three girls, one's 14, 13, and one is 8 or 9, and they all three have shot 3 and 4-point bucks already. My son has got one of them mounted over in his house. I mean, it's a humongous buck. It's the legacy from me teaching my son how to fish and hunt with our little boat. He has got it into these girls that you have to go do something in the woods. And they ride four-wheeler. And they go on up with him over on Zaremba. They drive the logging roads. Then they get out and walk when they can't drive. And these girls are good. They got some small, high-powered rifle they use. Not much kick. And they ride in there cleaning it, helping them pack it and drag it, and they're up here in my deer hanging shed, and they're helping us wrap it, cut it. And now we got a grandson, 16 months old, and he's already into throwing rocks and swinging golf clubs, and I know we're going to have to really get to that kid. We're retired here in Wrangell now and live right on the beach next to eagles flying right by as we're making this tape. And the other day, my wife and I looked out the window, and right out in front of us was two great big humongous otter, gray-faced old buggers, sitting within 100 feet of our house staring at us. Most of the winter, a lot of mallards and geese sitting here watching us. And so it's nice here.
So the outdoor lifestyle has really been boring to you?
Oh, yeah. I've lived my whole life practically in the air or in the woods. That's why I don't like the States. I feel more at home here on the beach, or if I could go out walking in the brush somewhere, which, like I said, my legs don't let me go too far anymore, but that's been my life ever since I was a little kid when we come to Alaska in 38. I was hunting and fishing for a living for our family. My dad was a boat builder, and we didn't have much money in the 30s and 40s, and I would get a lot of deer, and we'd catch a lot of halibut. Same way in Bethel when we lived up there. We lived on moose meat and king salmon. And ptarmigan. I love to go out hunting ptarmigan out in the flats behind Bethel. In fact, they'd come through Bethel in the winter, and they'd hit the power lines. And you could go around the street and pick them up. Had a lot of fun doing that. And a few rabbits. Did some good fishing up there, too, in some of the rivers at the Yakutat. Shot a few nice moose up there, sea duck, and did some beautiful rainbow and cutthroat fishing there. Really nice. But that's been my whole life. I wouldn't have traded for anybody else. And there's so many people now that have to spend thousands and thousands of dollars of what I did all my life. Anyway, that's the story, and there's a lot more to go, but I think we're running out of time and money and airspeed, altitude, and runway. That's the end of it. Thank you.
That brings us to the end of our interview with Herman Ludwigson of Wrangell. I hope that you enjoyed listening to his stories as much as I did. Tune in again next week when we'll feature another old-timer here on Alaska Tracks.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.